Welcome to the Dahlgren Centennial Celebration, a century of innovation. We hope that this and our many other products, events, and offerings will showcase what Dahlgren has accomplished during its last 100 years. Throughout our history, we've interviewed some of the most prominent minds, leaders, and innovators that have been here, and we're opening up the vault to share them with you this year. Today, we're honored to listen to the story of Dr. Charles C. Bramble. Dr. Bramble first came to Dahlgren in 1942, but had contacts with the base as early as 1924. Dr. Bramble served as the head of the Exterior Ballistics Section and served as the head of the Computations and Ballistics Department. Later, he was appointed as the Director of Research, a predecessor to the Technical Director position. Dr. Bramble was heavily involved with the early computing abilities of the base, particularly the Mark II Aiken Relay Calculator. Now let's listen to Dr. Bramble.
The first question is, what was your connection at Dahlgren when you had contacts with him in 1920?
Well, my first contact with Dahlgren was in 1924. And in those days, there was no bridge across the river. I used to call up and they'd send a boat over to Morgantown for me, and I'd leave my car with the captain chauffeur. There, he kept a car on the Morgantown side, because in those days, the commanding officer at Dahlgren was also commanding officer at Indian Head. So it go across by boat. And in those days, used to be there was a frequent trip by boat up the Potomac to Washington. People, the wives of people who lived there, would go up on the boat to do shopping. And there was also a railroad from Dahlgren to Fredericksburg, and that persisted until about the end of the war, as I recall. I think they had.
What was your connection when you came down in 24?
Well, when I came down there, I was just from general interest in ordnance problems. You see, I was teaching ordnance courses at the Naval Postgraduate School, and I was on the Naval Postgraduate School faculty. And I was teaching ordnance courses, including ballistics and gun design, and exterior and interior ballistics. And naturally, I was interested in the current problems in those areas. So that periodically, I would get in touch with Dr. Thompson, who was at that time the senior scientist there at Dahlgren. And I'd go down and probably stay overnight or stay a day or two, and then of course return. But it was a very informal contact. But that was my way of keeping a live interest in current ordnance problems and the investigation work and research that was going on. And at that time, I also did the same sort of thing in connection with the Army proving ground at Aberdeen. That sort of thing, I think, made me gave them a natural interest in my field of interest. My so-called expertise in that field, so that when the national emergency came on and they decided to move the ballistic work from the Bureau of, out of Washington, from the Bureau of Ordnance, they decided to put it at Dahlgren, and they requested the postgraduate school to have me transferred to Dahlgren. But the postgraduate school wouldn't agree to that. But so they compromised on my spending 4 days a week at Dahlgren. So at that time, my family stayed here, and I lived at the BOQ in Dahlgren. And that was the beginning of the ballistic work and the beginning of the computation laboratory, because at that time, there were only two mathematicians employed at Dahlgren, and they were people of about, I don't know, I think there were about, only about GS 7 or 9 level.
And what year was this?
That was back in about 1942.
Before Annie came?
Before he came. Before any of the reserve officers came. That I went down there, was the only people there were Scott and Barker in the mathematical work, in the computation work. And there were a couple of women who were about GS 5 level. And that was the start. And the that work was under the, was organizationally was under the main battery, the main, under what they call the ordnance officer, who was the second, was he the second, I guess he?
The ordnance officer was third in command, wasn't he? No, he was second in command.
He was second in command.
I have an organizational chart on that.
Yes, there was a deputy commander, but it seems to me that the ordnance officer was really the deputy commander.
Right.
Whenever
the commander was off the station,
the I think I've had what? Did you have Admiral Withington as one of your students?
Yes, Admiral Withington, Admiral Parsons, Admiral Turner Joy.
Really?
Yes, Admiral Hussey, mm-hmm. Admiral Blandy, Admiral Schoeffel.
Mm-hmm. A lot of our commanders.
Admiral Parsons, did I say?
Yes.
Admiral
yes.
Parsons, Admiral Vewig.
How do you spell that name?
V-I-E-H-W-E-G. The ordnance group at the postgraduate school usually consisted of only about 8 or 10 officers. And they had more courses with me than with any other single faculty member. And in fact, they stayed at the school longer than most of the groups. They stayed there 1.5 or 2 years. So that I got to know them very well. And we had very pleasant relationships, and a good many of these continued through the years. Among those, I might mention Captain W.H. Benson, who has been a good friend of mine these many years. Also, Captain Al Malm, Captain George King, and many others.
Admiral King?
No. By the way, when I first went to the, I first came to the Naval Academy in 1917, and I was in the Department of Mathematics for 2 years. That was during World War I. Then the postgraduate school opened up under Captain King, later Admiral King, in 1919, and I was appointed to the faculty there at that time, and I remained on the faculty there officially until I went into uniform in 1942, and still continued then, and was back again after I was out of uniform in 46, and remained at the postgraduate school as a civilian on the faculty until 47. The proving ground. Saying the things that you want to hear or not?
You sure are. And that's the time you transferred to Dahlgren, right?
I transferred to Dahlgren. The proving ground, there was a question of whether I'd stay in regular Navy or proving ground was interested in my continuing in the work that I'd started during the war. You see, we had started the computational laboratory. So I decided I would come back as civilian. As things turned out, I'm happy that was the decision. Because in 1947, my family and I moved to Dahlgren, and we occupied quarters 508 for 7 years.
You mentioned Dr. Thompson. Could you tell us something about his work and the man himself?
He came there, he was, as I recall it, he was technically classified as a physicist, and he was the chief scientist, the senior scientist, although there was no title of that sort at the time. There were two or three others that came later as civilians. I think came about 1934. I think that's when Allen came.
No, 39, Allen.
39? Well, when did Don Stoner come?
Don Stoner was there when Allen came.
I thought that
and
Stoner...
And Russell was there.
I think Don Stoner came in
34, I thought. I think it was around 34. But there were just a very small handful of civilian scientific personnel. The rest of the people were essentially all trained on the job at the batteries, main battery, machine gun battery, and so forth. So that the actual highly trained technical competence was rather scant in those days. But they had various ordnance problems. I remember back in those days, one of the serious problems was the unexpected dispersion in connection with the 14-inch batteries on the 14-inch gun battleships. And that was studied for a long time.
What was Dr. Thompson like? Was he a manager?
Had a very pleasant personality. He really got along very well with people. I think he was very diplomatic in dealing with the naval personnel in command. And also, I think he developed quite a bit of, you might say, clout in dealing with the Bureau of Ordnance through the years. He got to be well known and respected. Of course, one of the advantages that I had when I came into this work, that the personnel who were in command positions in the Bureau of Ordnance were ex-students of mine and practically all personal friends. Mm-hmm. For instance, Admiral Schofield, Admiral Hussey, and later on, Admiral Burke, I think of some others. That was always helpful in expediting our programs. One of the reasons they were interested in having me come there was that Dr. Thompson was leaving.
Is that right?
And he left to go with Norton Laboratories.
Right.
And because Norton Laboratories had the mission of establishing the Indianapolis plant for the Indianapolis Ordnance plant for the Bureau of Ordnance, and he went to Indianapolis and was there during the war. And then later on, as an outgrowth of that, and a lot of his ideas, the Bureau of Ordnance started China Lake. So that's the way that came about. And of course, out at China Lake, not exactly at China Lake, but they have, I don't know whether it's in, I don't know exactly where it is, but there's the Thompson Laboratory.
Oh, it is? Named after Dr. Thompson?
Yes, that's named after Dr. Thompson.
Is that
on the station?
I think so.
I think it's on the station. But they have another facility that's in closer to Los Angeles. And I forget just where it is. I've been there. Tommy went to, as the technical director out the ordnance plant, and he took Carl Schaefer with him. Carl Schaefer was a Dalber. He went to Indianapolis. Later, they closed out the Indianapolis plant at the end of the war. And he went to White Plains, and so did Dr. Thompson. He went to White Plains because that's where the Norton plant was. And that's where that was the office that I was in when I was at White Plains with Norton.
Was that the home office or like a branch?
That was the home office at that time.
How long was he at China Lake?
Oh, really? I don't know. He was. I went to Norton at White Plains in 1954.
Yes.
And
he was there when you
He went. Was there and been there some years, I think, at that time. And he and Carl Schaefer were both there at Norton. And then when Dr. Thompson retired from Norton, Carl Schaefer took over the technical directorship. The latter part of my stay there. When I went to Norton, I went there. I went there with the idea of having a staff job because I wanted a job that I could walk out on for a month or two and travel if I wanted to. But without having a direct responsibility for a program, you see. So I was not a project engineer. I was what they call a staff engineer. It was somewhat of a general consultant for the plant with particular interest in ballistics and computation and associated instrumentation. At the time before the ordnance plant opened up, when the ordnance plant opened, one of the things they were interested in manufacturing, of course, was the Norden bomb site. Dahlgren was the test place before that for the Norden bomb site. And they had a test facility there. All the Norden bomb sites were sent there for tests.
Was Dr. Thompson involved in?
In a general way, yes. Involved technically and also and rather intimately in the details of the organization and running of bomb site laboratory.
What were some of your major duties?
On temporary duty to Dahlgren, which was really a steady job, I was instructed to develop the facility for production of the Navy range and bombing tables. At the time I went there, there were only two desk-type computers in the place. That's all they had, two mathematicians. And among the difficulties of getting things going, I can give you one minor incident. I immediately saw we were going to need more desk-type calculators, so I put in a request to have them get five more. And I came back here on Thursday evening. When I went back on Monday, I found that the order had been changed to two for the ballistic work and two for the so-called velocity measurement. And I was somewhat appalled by that, and because I think it was difficult to impress the command of the necessity for this kind of work. But it was just a matter of a very few months before we were up to about 50 desk-type calculators. We had about 50. They built the
218.
First wing there, and to my amazement, when they took down the forms off the concrete work, instead of it being a ballistic building, it had velocity building on the front of it. And there was a financial reason for that. I don't need to go into. I mean, because of some of the bureaucratic goings on in the Bureau of Ordnance, there was really a reason for it. But you can correct me on this, that shortly after I was there, we put in requests for mathematical talent in the Naval Reserve. And I forget whether we got Dr. Dresch, who was from Stanford University, and Dr. Kemper, and Dr. Cohen. But then we brought in some wave officers, and the senior one was Eva Jane. And there were four others that had mathematical training, and one or two others that went into different departments. One was a librarian, the other one served as an administrative assistant in the commanding officer's office. Oh, by the way, there was also Dr. Gutzman, and Walter Jennings Hickman. Actually, the way the thing worked, I immediately put them to work studying ballistics and giving us some lectures on ballistics and setting up the computational procedures. And they taught the wave officers what to do to manage enlisted waves who pounded these desk-type computers in the computational nitty-gritty, you see, the real dirt-type computation. So that's the way we spread what we knew. And we soon had a laboratory going there with Dr. McMillan and also his wife, who was also a PhD, and she was in the mathematical work. And McMillan, however, was attached to
velocity.
He was attached to the velocity work, was it? Was it over to the projectile laboratory that Ralph Sawyer? No, McMillan, I guess he didn't stay there too long after that. And I think they were both Harvard graduates.
What was your involvement with the Aiken relay calculator?
Later on, we began to see the first development of what we might refer to as large-scale program calculators. We saw that Aiken had developed the Mark I, which was electromechanical at the Harvard Computation Laboratory, and also Bell Labs had developed a relay calculator for purposes associated with design work, connection with Bell Telephone. We saw the necessity for the importance of getting large-scale computers into the operation of ballistic work. And I've got to make a digression here, because also at this same time we developed a contract with MIT to have them operate for us the Bush differential analyzer. They ran a great many of our basic trajectories for the firing tables and bombing tables.
Then they sent the...
They sent the output. This was a large scale, the largest scale analog computer. MIT had an analog computer too that may have been somewhat larger. Yes, that came down, and we polished it up and developed the rest of the subsidiary data that was essential to the firing tables, all the so-called differential effects. And then we, seeing the necessity for our desirability of having a large-scale calculator of our own, I had some consultations with Bell Labs, with Harvard Computation Laboratory, MIT, and Dr. von Neumann at Princeton. As a result of that, through the Bureau of Ordnance, a contract was given to the Harvard Computation Laboratory for the development of the Mark II calculator. That was the first one. Incidentally, about the same time, or I think prior to the Mark II, I had a consultation with IBM, who had charge later of the production of the nautical almanac for the Navy. He was at the Naval Observatory. And he later went with IBM. IBM developed a couple of small relay computers. They were probably 4 or 5 feet long and 4 feet high and a couple feet wide. That took up that much space. They built three of them, and they placed two of them at Aberdeen and one of them with us. They called it the 799 relay computer, and they placed it with us to have us experiment with it and see what we could actually do with it in the way of practical computation. That was under Heiser's jurisdiction. We put in quite a good deal of IBM equipment to it, and did a lot of our computation work with IBM cards, that sort of thing, before we got Mark II. Then Aiken developed the Mark II for us, shipped it down, we got it going there, and what a time we had getting the bugs worked out of that. The programming was rather difficult, and there were lots of failures and accuracy, and a great deal of difficulty in troubleshooting, but we did a lot with it, nevertheless. And then as a consequence of that program, followed up by a research program to the Harvard Computation Laboratory to investigate the feasibility of a fully electronic calculator. Aberdeen, at the same time, under Eckert and Mauchly, with connection with Eckert and Mauchly, had developed the electronic computer called the ENIAC at Aberdeen. Of course, I was also in consultation with them and with the progress they were making, and made frequent trips to Harvard and kept in touch with Aiken, and so also did Dr. Dresch, who was my first assistant.
What was the name of that community we were just talking about?
ENIAC?
Yes.
ENIAC. As a result of this research contract with Harvard Computation Laboratory, we were able to have the Mark III developed.
Well,
the first was a relay calculator and completely relay and tape and punch tape. Now the Mark III was electronic with a magnetic drum memory and used magnetic tape. There were two types of memory with that calculator. The high-speed memory was the magnetic drum, which rotated at high speed, and then a number of tape mechanisms. I think there were four tape mechanisms on the Mark III that carried magnetic tape, and they were what we referred to as the memory with low speed access. The next development was the development of the NORC. You may have a brief history of that already. Let's say that the next development of Dahlgren was the fact that Buer decided to locate the NORC at Dahlgren. That really put the computation laboratory in big time calculation, because it was so far and away beyond anything else at that time. Far and away greater capacity. Mm-hmm. Speed is what really leads to capacity. Well, that brings us up just about, I think the NORC was just about to be delivered. Well, about that time, I was approached by Norton Laboratory. Decision was pending when Norton approached me to come with them. And I talked with Admiral Parsons and Admiral Schopel about it. And they proposed that I stay at Dahlgren until the NORC situation. And I proposed that I stay there until the NORC situation was fully firmed up. And the NORC came, I think, was delivered very shortly after I left in 54. That was really, I think, one of the turning points in the history of the laboratory. And was it about that time that we got the, just when did we get, the K Laboratory building?
That wasn't until 64.
Yeah, Neiman was.
Mark II
we never
and the Mark III were dismantled. And the NORC was put in, wasn't it, in the same building. And then I left the Naval Proving Ground in January 54. In fact, today is the 31st of January.
That's right.
And that's the anniversary of my being transferred from the postgraduate school to Dahlgren. That was in 47. Then I left Dahlgren on the 31st of January, 54, and I left Norton on the 31st of January, 58.
In 1951, you were appointed as Dahlgren's first director.
Yes,
1951.
Right, yeah.
That is, I think I was actually functioning.
Functioning as that before.
Before that.
As
functioning in the sense as the technical director of
The
station.
Right.
But I was not so designated, I think, until 51.
Let me ask you this next question. We were talking about you being officially appointed Director of Research in 51. This was a period of heavy proof and test during the Korean War. What did you see as the mission at that time?
The mission of the station was to do research on weapon systems and to also to carry out test work on systems under development, and also proof work for production. That is, down there in the early days, you hear guns all day long because they used to have so much ammunition testing.
Did you see any trends developing at the proving ground?
Of course, in the early days, it was just a test station, and Dr. Thompson was always interested in research. And he, in his early days, had worked with Goddard on rocket work at Clark University, so that he was always interested in getting more and more research work, because that's where one's intellectual interests naturally lie, not just in the routine test work. Test work had some interesting statistical problems, not the sort of challenge that you'd have on doing research work. So the trend through the years has been to do more and more things that might be classified as research and development until it is right now, and you know more about that than I do. I haven't been enough in touch with it to know just what the relationship is now between, say, one facility down there that has been developed has been this satellite surveillance work. And the thing that reflects that is the change in the name of the station.
Can you tell us something of the work of Mr. Riffle, who succeeded you as the director of Dahlgren?
Mr. Riffle came to this country from Sweden. He came to Clark University, and he was originally an instrument maker, and he was a very skillful laboratory technician. He was more of a technician than an engineer. I'm not saying that in a derogatory sense at all, but that is the situation. But he was very skillful in that field, very precise. He worked with Dr. Thompson at Clark University, and he was brought to Dahlgren by Dr. Thompson and under his influence. I've since, in much the same sense that I brought in people like Cohen and Kemper and Neiman, Gutzman and Ritter. They had the predecessor of what became what do they call it now, the projectile laboratory, or? Yes, A&P laboratory, Arm projectile laboratory. He was Lisa Riffle was really the predecessor of that laboratory.
Optimistic about Dahlgren's future when you retired in January 54.
Yes, I really was. Yes, I was optimistic because they were getting the north. And I felt that was really going to give them a very solid foundation for a going computation laboratory, and I felt that the computation laboratory was really very essential to the Bureau of Ordnance, and I thought that we had developed an excellent staff there at that time. We had a lot of really very competent people. We had Dr. Hershey and Dr. Cohen, Dr. Kemper, Mr. Neiman, Ryland, and Dave Brown. So that I felt very optimistic about it. I left, not that I wasn't interested at all, but it was just the force of the economic circumstances, because I had offers from two commercial outfits, and at my age and with the expenses I had with a son in college, I felt that I couldn't afford to refuse to take it and at the same time draw my retired annuity. So that's why I left. Not that I wanted to leave. We enjoyed the life there at Dahlgren very much, and enjoyed the association, and in fact enjoyed the professional life. It was financially advantageous to leave, and I just felt that it, for the sake of my family, I couldn't afford not to do it. I regretted it. It was an interesting experience, however. In general, I have only minor regrets about the situation, because I did have a lot of interesting experiences in connection with Norton.
Thank you for listening to this week's Dahlgren Centennial Podcast, and hopefully you've learned another interesting aspect of what our people accomplish for the Navy and for our nation. We will continue sharing how Dahlgren is a one-of-a-kind location where innovation is heralded as the hallmark of each individual. Tune in next time to hear from Woodrow Saft, a naval gun expert who started working at Dahlgren in the early 1940s.